Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who knows exactly what a counter-jamming frequency projector looks like. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And we are heading onto the planet Zanak for the pirate planet.
Well, this is my fourth favourite story in the Key to Time season, and that's not a bad thing. Okay, I really enjoy the first four stories a lot. The other three around this, I like a little bit more. But, you know, we have to thank Anthony Reid for bringing Douglas Adams to the table, to television. In the documentary that's on the DVD with this, he says that Douglas had great ideas, they just needed to be put into a structure. And here I think he generally does succeed. I think one of the greatest things about Douglas's work, and one of his greatest limitations, is the fact that the ideas that he presents are so big and overarching that sometimes I think the technology at the time doesn't quite match what is required to visually interpret things, and certainly a few aspects in this story. But I generally like this story quite a lot.
It's a really just a terribly funny script, isn't it?
Yeah,
it really is. And, you know, there are a few things that he mines for comedy all the way through. So there's all of these sort of absurd names for the various minerals that they're mining, you know, ullium and madronite 1-5 and PJX 1-8 and all of that sort of thing. And all the planets have sort of silly names, you know, Zanak and Calufrax. And then there's all the technobabble as well. You know, that's probably just an old Macromat field integrator or something. And all of that, which will sort of carry on next year when he takes over as script editor, all of it just adds a kind of lightness of tone to the whole proceedings, which is a little bit deceptive, really, given...
Yeah, it's quite dark in terms of content when you get to the actual concept of the story and what's happening. Again, a lot like the last story, death in this story isn't just swept under the rug. When the Doctor explains to Kimus and Romana what's going on, Kimus actually takes a moment and gets really upset about, you know, what's been happening with this planet.
So we've got this high concept, which is a hollow planet that materializes around other planets and mines them. And it's a ridiculous high concept premise, but as you say, it becomes real when we're told that it has been materializing around populated planets and killing, like, literally hundreds of millions of people.
What's the old guy's name?
Oh, Balaton.
We do need to talk about the performances.
Yeah. Well, let's start with we've got a nice TARDIS scene, I think, at the beginning of the story, which I quite like, and the Doctor talks about 523 years operating the TARDIS, so we've got a bit of a time frame to things. I don't know whether that's quite true.
No, it would be contradicted in by Drax in the Armageddon Factor quite soon.
And I love the fact that they put the first segment of the Key to Time in an old fridge. I mean, that's always a great thing to see.
The limbo cupboard.
So they have that room, don't they?
That, like, black room.
The black room.
With the old-style fridge.
Yeah.
And it is called the limbo room. That's what it said. That's what it's called in the script.
Oh, okay.
I believe Graham Williams' concept was, you know, if the TARDIS is infinite and infinitely adjustable, because we've seen so many different console rooms, then you don't actually need a corridor leading to a specific place. As soon as you walk out the door, the TARDIS will scan your brain and put what you want on the other side of the door. You know, they never explain it, because why would the Doctor have to explain that to Romana? She knows all about TARDISes. But I love it. And we see a couple of times this season they go through that door and there's a different thing on the other side.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
There's a wardrobe at one point, isn't there?
Tahiti.
No, we'll come back to that. I love that. And, of course, Mary gets to wear her lovely pink jacket, white outfit, very sort of Bucks Fizz, whatever it happens to be, I think.
It is very period, isn't it, that outfit?
Yeah. I love it on her. I think Mel takes a bit of inspiration many years later for her little pink and white number, but, you know, I'm sure we'll discuss that sometime along the track. Again, Romana is trying to dematerialise the TARDIS, and at the same time as Zanak materialises around Calufrax, and so we get the Doctor having to bump his lip and explain all of the Tom's
dog attack,
yep. And then, of course, we get the renter crowd. We get BBC renter crowd.
There's eight people in that crowd, I counted.
Hooray!
Oh, and they're so overjoyed.
Sorry, I wasn't sure when to enthuse.
Yeah, no, Zanak is actually populated by some pretty terrible actors, actually. So there's Balaton, who's the grandfather, who is just appallingly stilted in his delivery. There's his daughter Mula, which is just the worst name of anyone ever. Like, is she a mule or does she mule a lot? Do you know what I mean?
She does get a very good comedy moment, and it does involve him as well, but I think it's all down to her. Like, what was it? My father wasn't killed by the Mentiads. No, he was shot by the captain's guards to save him from the Mentiads.
But she's the one who delivers the immortal line, why?
But I think she makes up for it with, you mean they pinned him to the wall with good vibrations?
Yeah, no, she's terrible. Prelix is terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keymus isn't bad, and of course he was Mr. Louise Jameson at the time, David Warwick.
Oh, okay. Mm. Yes, and he's been in the new series.
Yes, he was the police commissioner reporting that the ghosts were harmless. Oh, no, wait, stay in your homes, is that by a Cyberman.
Yeah, excellent.
Yes, that's one of the things I will say about this, is those performances do sort of let the side down a bit. I mean, it's nice to have another woman in the cast doing something, you know, who's not an evil crone or whatever it happens to be. I think that's quite good. I do laugh at the grandfather and the fact that he's quite willing to take all these riches and I don't want to know what's going on, just putting his head in the sand, so to speak, as long as he gets what he wants. I think it would have been quite nice at the other end of the story, perhaps, to see some sort of...
Yeah, some development.
Realisation of and remorse as to that sort of thing. But I kind of think it's a bit like maybe the British Empire and what they did to so many countries around the world.
Well, I mean, it's like capitalism, really. Do you know what I mean? Like, all of us listening to this podcast on our, you know, expensive devices and things, all of us as consumers are, you know, in some way complicit in... you know, the exploitation and suffering experienced by people elsewhere in the world. And we would just prefer not to think about that too much. Mm. And that's what this planet is. You know, it's a planet of consumption, a planet that eats other planets, but no one on the planet can see a problem and no one on the planet actually wants to think about it too much. And the whole economy of the planet makes no sense. The Doctor realises it straight away. But... as Balaton says, we just don't ask questions about it because, you know, the answers to those questions are too terrible. So there is a kind of real intent, I think, behind the, you know, silly sci-fi high concept of the premise.
I quite like Prelix. I actually think he does quite a good job. And certainly with the setup of the Mentiads, so you think that they're actually evil and you get them knocking out the Doctor at the end of the episode, so you're thinking that, you know, that's a real problem. But, of course, it's quite the opposite, as we come to discover. I love all the stuff with the Doctor and Romana when they first arrive in the square and the Doctor's having no luck with the local residents and it's up to the wonderful Mary Tam Romana to... Well,
it's actually K-9's idea. Yeah. Doesn't
she
K-9...
She is prettier than you, Master.
Is she?
But the fact that Romana gets to, oh, yes, and she's so jovial and would you like a jelly baby and all of that and the Doctor's there trying to, you know, butt in, but, of course, getting nowhere. I just sit there. The whimsy of it all just tickles my fancy. I just love it.
Where did you get those? Same place as you, your pocket.
I love the Doctor saying, has anyone seen a planet? You know, he describes it about so big, oblate spheroid, you know. Like, all of that is just terrifically funny, and we'll get more of that sort of stuff next year.
Then, of course, we go up the mountain to...
The
bridge. And we've got the pirate captain, Mr. Fibberley, a number of guards... who wear those, what are those?
The helmets? Helmets are terrible, aren't they?
I believe they're versions of, they're not the original, but they seem to be versions of an Ice Lord helmet.
Well, they look like the Blake 7 helmets, actually. Aren't they? They're very 1978.
So you can have the same person playing the same guard because you actually can't see their eyes and that sort of thing over and over again just to save a bit of money if you need to. Mm. Mm.
Yes, unfortunately, we don't have Terry Walsh anymore. He's not a guard.
Will.
Yes, we will. Oh, yeah. He's not completely gone, but he's not in this.
All right, so we're on the bridge and we've got the captain, Mr. Fibberley, and the nurse.
You said last week in the last episode that you didn't enjoy the pirate captain's performance when you were a kid. What do you think about it now?
When I started watching this, I just think, oh, this is so over the top. This is so annoying. But as the story went along, and I always forget the big twist in the fact that his performance is that big because he's actually doing something else to stop Queen Xanxia. I always forget it. So then in retrospect, I go, well, actually, that's really good. And I still feel that now. I think it's a good performance, but it's so big. And then he's got his demented Leo Sayer next to him, right? And as a kid, I thought, this is a demented Leo Sayer. And if you don't know who that is, young people, go and look him up on the internet.
And get off Todd's lawn.
1970s pop star. And I really, really loathed that character even more as a child. Now I think it's a really great performance. And again, it's a comedy double act, and certainly with his death at the end. And it's, you know, very heartbreaking and sort of, you know, it's a lovely character moment. I think they're actually really wonderful in this.
I actually would have liked to have seen a little bit more light and shade in Bruce Purchase's performance. We're going to see this happening more and more, and it's something that Douglas Adams talked about, which is the moment that you put humour in a script, actors take the opportunity to kind of do funny voices and ham it up. And from here, very much the humour in the script and the high concept and the robot parrot and all of that sort of stuff is all there to distract you from the fact that something really terrible is happening. Mm-hmm. And that shift, that tonal shift, is really exemplified in the pirate captain's performance. So he's a blustering, over-the-top Doctor Who villain who has, you know, a great line in sort of hilarious imprecations. I like by the left frontal lobe of the sky demon, for instance. But when it's revealed that it is a long game, that it's just a ploy and he's trying to throw Queen Xanxia off the scent, it's a shame that we don't get to see what he's really like. He does dial it back a bit, but it never becomes real, and I think that's a mistake.
I think a big problem of it is sort of when he turns on Xanxia, he just kind of says, I'll be free of you, you hag, and then she kills him. And it's like, I would have liked a longer speech there, which would have emphasised, I've been waiting years for this and you thought I was just a fool, blah, blah, blah. And that would have actually made his death a bit more palpable, because halfway through that speech, you'd go, he's actually kind of a good guy, you know, he's about to be redeemed, he's about to be, oh, he's dead.
Yeah.
Instead, we just get, I'll be free of you, you hag. Wait, what? Oh, he's dead. Oh, he was on the, okay.
I think that's a really good point that you've both made. Like, if he'd had the opportunity to rein it down and actually see the real person, it would have made it a real performance, whether it's, it becomes this just over-the-top thing, which is kind of what I was saying.
Yeah, like the script wants that to be a definite performance, do you know what I mean? And it's brilliant in that it gives you the opportunity to have a fun, over-the-top Doctor Who villain without completely throwing away the justification for it.
Mm.
We should talk about Xanxia as well.
Which one?
Well, the nurse appears on screen at the bridge in part two, and she just gradually gets more and more important, and she's really menacing, and you can't say why exactly.
Yeah, she's just got that stillness and quietness.
I loved her as a kid. It's the one thing of this story I really, really loved, and I still love the fact that in the background.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like, well, why is she there? And you know how she wears that little control box thing on her hip. I wanted one of those. You know? And I love the fact that she could control things. And then, you know, the memory cheats. I thought that when she got shot, she actually appeared over the A-frame bridge, which, of course, is back, you know, after Underworld and the Robots of Death and Planet of Evil.
Yeah.
But I thought she actually appeared there, but, of course, she just flickers in and out in that one spot. I love Rosalind Lloyd's performance. I love the split up the side of the skirt when she's standing on the A-frame leading up to the plank.
Yeah.
And I just love her performance. I just think it's fantastic.
She's a great villain, actually, and she does sort of come out of nowhere, and I think it is very clever. And it is a complex plot, and one of the things that Douglas Adams does, and apparently this had been pared back, it used to be more complex, but he's very good at very tight plotting, and he doesn't leave any loose ends. And anything that appears to be like a weird continuity thing actually ends up getting an explanation. And so here, there are three reasons for Xanak to be doing the piracy thing. Initially, we think it's just to create wealth and riches. Then we discover that the captain is making a thing out of the planet's remains in order to disrupt the time dams that are keeping Queen Xanxia alive and thereby kill her. And then we discover that it's actually the power being consumed by the time dams that Queen Xanxia is doing it all to stay alive.
And create herself a new body in the form of the Rosalind Lloyd Xanxia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But can you explain that to me? Because, like, she's creating this new body, which the Doctor picks up what appears to be some sort of camera to create his fake self, right?
Yeah.
And so I'd assume that she would need multiple cameras in the control room to sort of create this stable sort of version of herself. This is where I don't sort of get it. And so the Doctor has to project his fake self to jump off the literal cliffhanger, right?
Yeah.
But then if somebody was to stand in front of it, surely that would disrupt the signal and it wouldn't be there?
Well, I think it's, you know, as far advanced from what we would see as a projector as what we see as a projector is to a kinescope.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's magic.
It's
a magic box.
It's a magic
makes
box.
Makes people.
It doesn't quite work in my head.
Yeah.
Like the pirate captain's performance, right? And like a few other visual effects. Like, you know, they have a really good go at the flying car, which I would, again, in my, if you're listening to last week's, you know, I have got the movie series in my head. So they could do that a lot better. I love Romana's whole whimsy at the whole car and the whole flying and everything, you know. Didn't she have one herself or something?
She had one. She got one for 100 and, no, for her 70th birthday.
Yeah, something like that.
And we've got when the whole bridge does explode, like the explosion is so big that the whole city underneath should surely be wiped out. You know, we've got one of the worst special effects ever, which is with the spanner hitting the engines and you've got the faces of the Doctor and the Mentiads and It's just awful. It's just, but it just doesn't work. And this is little things like that, those little things that for me just sort of pair this back just a little bit from the other three stories around it. And then we've got a parrot. A parrot that apparently, I never realised as a kid, it was actually emanating yellow urine. I never realised. And I'm watching this and going, what the hell is this?
It's brilliant. The parrot is fantastic. Yeah, so it's called a polyphase avatron, which is poly for short. So again, that's a brilliant choice of names. And of course, K9 ends up carrying it in his mouth somehow, which he doesn't sort of normally do. But he ends up having a fight with it, which is what we all wanted as children to see.
I agree, I think it's
great. You know, he doesn't have an eye patch. He's got an electronic eye patch. He doesn't have a hook. He's got an electronic arm. He doesn't have a parrot. He's got an electronic parrot. So I think all of that works terribly well.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just saying, like, you know, I never realised like the colour of it.
Yeah, it is urine, isn't it?
But as a kid, it was like, yes, I wanted to see the parrot versus K9. Like,
we all did.
That was the thing that wanted to be. I must say in this story that both Kimis and Romana are very good shots with a gun.
Yeah, Romana kills someone.
Oh, I prefer to think that she's just stunned.
Yeah, no, she killed him.
But Romana has a sort of Daphne Zuniga in Spaceballs moment of he shot my hair.
And doesn't K9 fly the car as well?
Yeah, K9 flies the car. Yeah, yeah. Oh. I mean, the car, which is absolutely, positively not a copy of the Landspeeder in Star Wars. How dare you say such thing? No, we didn't just buy a toy.
Is it actually a speedboat? Like, I actually think it might be a speedboat that they brought into the studio.
Quite possibly, yeah. But, you know, the sort of red colouring, it doesn't leave much to the imagination. Some behind-the-scenes info. Douglas Adams came up with the air car because he hated scenes in corridors. And you'll notice that there are very few scenes of people just walking through a featureless white corridor, Terry Nation. There's the Doctor and the Mentiads occasionally in a corridor, but that's pretty much it. We do have the induction corridor where people wander through, but I'll come back to that in a moment.
That's one of my favourite moments of this story where the Doctor talks about Newton's revenge. We shouldn't tamper with the laws of physics, should we, Romana? And they're standing there and it goes click, click, and the guards go vroom, straight into the
wall.
Smashing the wall. I just crack up every single time. It's whimsy and silliness that I do love in Douglas Adams / Anthony Reed scripts.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's Douglas Adams' joke about corridors. He hates corridors so much that he makes one that kills you. like the rotating knives in Monty Python.
Well, that's full of Hitchhiker's Inn jokes as well. You know, the first time the Doctor's in the corridor, he says he'll never be cruel to an electron in a particle accelerator again.
Yes,
and
yeah.
And that's, you know, I'll never be cruel to a gin and tonic again is what Arthur Dent says. And, you know, he talks to the guards and talks about the violence and the long hours and what a boring job it must be. And some of the names of the planets and stuff. So it is full of Hitchhiker's references.
And the bit where Tom, like, knocks on the guard's helmet was completely unscripted, and Mary's reaction, but Romana's reaction is Mary's reaction. She almost burst out laughing just because she wasn't expecting Tom to do that to the poor actor inside the helmet. The script itself, which is quite common for Douglas Adams, was far more complex to begin with. Mm. Xanxia was actually a Time Lord in the midst of his last regeneration, and that's why he was slowing time down. And his next planet for the pirate planet to go around wasn't Earth, it was Gallifrey.
Oh, okay. I like the idea that it's Earth. I actually like to imagine it's Earth in 1978.
Oh, so. Yeah. It's contemporaneous. But I mean, the reason Graham Williams sort of said no to that was, look, you know, we've just done a story endangering Gallifrey. It'll be far more meaningful if it's endangering Earth, which is sort of what we would now consider a very Russell T. Davies thing. You know, it always has to come back to Earth. It always has to relate to Earth. Graham McDonald, the head of Serials, called for the pirate planet to be scrapped.
Because it was too silly?
Too silly. He didn't like the humour in the scripts. And Graham Williams, when it was being planned, had actually gone on his yearly holiday and broken his leg. So he wasn't up to much. But he did contact Graham McDonald and said, look, you brought me onto this series because it was too violent. I had to replace the violence and the horror with something. That's why we have comedy. The comedy is not undermining the drama. It's helping to sell the drama. And you approved me having this year-long story arc. We don't have time to produce something else to go in the middle of a year-long story arc. If you scrap that, you're scrapping part of our year-long story, which you said you really supported and liked. The comedy in this is fine. He's a new writer. We're not just going to put what you've read on the screen. We're going to edit it. Let us do our jobs. And he relented. So, yeah, a lot of people kind of see Graham Williams as this is the time when Doctor Who went wrong. But for the most part, we've really been enjoying Graham Williams' influence.
Yeah.
I certainly do. I mean, the problems we had last year with things like Underworld.
But this season is very strong. And this, what it is just fun. It's so fun.
Yeah, it is so fun. Do either of you find, though, that now that we don't have a human companion, are we losing the humanity of the show? Because that started to go out the window with Hinchcliffe. I think we've got it back.
I don't mind it. Do you know what I mean? Like, the fact is that she's really fun to watch. And like, you weren't really, you know, enjoying Jo because she was from the same planet as you, because secretly they're actually all from the same planet as you, even the Alzarians. You were watching it because she was sort of fun and plucky and lovely. And I think Mary is a real pleasure to watch. And you get the impression that they think the audience is smart and sophisticated enough to not need someone to have everything explained to them.
That's a good point. But I also think that in that one sense too, that the audience is smart and sophisticated. I just feel that we're now no longer aiming the show at 8 to 12-year-olds, right? I think we've shifted to an
up.
Up. And I think that's going to come and bite the show in the bum in a couple of years' time when ratings do suddenly take a dive. Like, we're not renewing that younger audience. We've got an audience that might have been around with John in the 10th season and in his last years and now getting older, and they're going to move on and go out with their friends and that sort of thing. And we're already seeing ratings beginning to erode. This season, there's only two episodes in the entire season over 10 million.
Right.
So there is a shrinkage happening, and we talk about the fact that Canines is for the kids and there's childish things going on, but it's really not that childish. And I think it is aiming for a different audience. Yeah.
Well, let's compare it to season 12, right? Season 12 is, you know, the beginning of the Hinchcliffe era. It's Tom's first year. And at the time, we talked about how kind of horrifying it was and suggested maybe it was a bit too scary for children. But the stories are overwhelmingly aliens in monster suits, do you know what I mean? Like, and Daleks and Cybermen and all of those traditional Doctor Who aliens. There are no traditional Doctor Who aliens this season at all. Do you know what I mean? The Taran wood beast doesn't count, Todd.
No, I was thinking of Kroll, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, Kroll isn't a man in a suit or a race of aliens or anything like that. The stories are about people.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I can kind of see that. But nevertheless, I think the show is really fun to watch, and maybe you're right, maybe it is pitched a little bit older than it has been in the past.
Yeah, I'm not saying I don't enjoy it. Like, I've enjoyed watching this story. You know, and I think there's a lot of fun elements. I think that, as we've discussed, there's some elements that, for me, just don't quite work at the same level as a few of the stories around it. But I think, you know, kudos to Anthony Reid for getting Douglas Adams in and making this story work.
Vi Delmar is, of course, the old Queen Xanxia sitting in the chair, who has such great things as David Warwick standing right next to her and saying, "Well, that old hag! Can she hear me?" And, of course, got paid an extra fee because they asked her, "Will you remove your false teeth to look particularly emaciated?" And she said, "Yes, but only if you pay me more money. I'm only appearing on television in a chair, not doing anything with my teeth out, if you pay me more." And they did. They paid her an extra fee.
I hope they paid Binro more for having his false teeth out in the previous story.
I think, though, that was his suggestion. A couple of years ago, I was an extra on Rescue Special Ops. Yeah, that was fun. And a friend of mine, Adam, got me into that. And we were sitting in the makeup chairs. And the makeup girls were great because we were part of a Mardi Gras float that had overturned. So everyone had to have different injuries. So the makeup girls were saying, "What injury would you like?" And so they gave me this head wound. So, like, half my face was covered in blood. And Adam, they said to him, "Well, what kind of injury would you like?" And he said, "Well, how about you do something with this?" And his two front teeth on the top, he had lost a few years previously, and he just pulled out the prosthetic. And the makeup girl said, "Oh, God, yes, I can do that. But for now, put them back in. So he just had this blood coming down from his mouth. It was quite graphic, and we were one minute of the episode. We were the pre-title sequence. and there was this drag queen suspended above a thing in Fox Studios. Nothing to do with the Pirate Planet, just to do with false teeth, really.
Yeah.
I never realised that the captain's boots are huge platforms. Did you see that when you were watching it?
Like, yeah, they're really quite huge. Tall. Yeah, they only show them, I think, once when he's making the Doctor pick something up. But yeah, at one point, after the Doctor's gone off the plank and you've got him standing up there next to Rosalind Lloyd and Mr. Fibberley, who are both quite short anyway, it really emphasises his height. Mm. Yeah.
But I do like the fact that this story integrates, that you've got location work, you know, you see them.
In fact, there's an old mine and everything.
Yeah,
there's
buildings. Yeah, to go down and see Caliphrax into the mine and then Muta, whatever her name is, walking along with K-9 and the Mentiads. It's just nice to have some location work in there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, can we talk very quickly about the end? I'm a huge fan of the end of this story, partly because they decide to blow the bridge up just with dynamite. You know, there's like no, like, there's a big wire that they're playing out and then a box with a plunger handle and everything. And I think that that's a fantastic way to go if you're going to have your episode 4 explosion. Let's just have it an explosion rather than an implosion or anything sort of particularly silly.
Yeah, the computer has computed far too much computer stuff and therefore it has to explode. Yeah.
But the other thing I like is that they just take getting Caliphrax as red. So we don't actually get the scene, this story, where you put the tracer on the thing and it turns into the Key to Time thing. We hold that over until, you know, next week. And it's just the Doctor and Romana waving goodbye and they're heading off to get the second segment, which they'll eventually get. And I think the season does a good job of not allowing the Key to Time thing to deform the stories.
But also, too, I mean, could you imagine on their budget trying to make that happen with
the whole planet?
I'm just there going, smart move.
Yeah.
And something that's quite nice about, not the very end, but when the Doctor kind of says, "Well, I drop the planets into the hyperspatial force shield and fling them off into the vortex ready for us to pick up later." And Romana says something along the lines of, "Yes, that's quite impressive," which throws back to, "I was almost ready to be impressed." She's like,
"Do you know, for me, actually, that's one of the weaknesses of the story, is that the resolution is the Doctor and Romana standing in the TARDIS talking a whole bunch of technobabble while a terrible special effect takes place on the screen. And it doesn't seem to be anything that the characters do beyond kind of pushing buttons and stuff like that. And that does happen a little bit too often this era. It certainly was a huge flaw in some of the stories last year, but it is something that we do get a bit of, and it's something that Bob Holmes is going to make terrible fun of later in the season.
Mm. But just before we go, there's two things I want to mention about the sort of climax of the story with the Doctor and Romana being mirror-launched to death in the TARDIS. That's another moment which I think is particularly well acted, because you've got the Doctor doing the psychic thing, so Romana's piloting the TARDIS and shouting at him, "No, you can't do that, we'll blow up," and you know, so but accepts that it's the heroic thing to do. This is also the scene which has given rise to Spannergate. Have you heard of Spannergate?
No.
Key to Time has had two DVD releases. It was released first in America, I think, in 2001, when the Doctor Who DVD range was starting in America. Warner Home Video, who released it over there, wanted a full season box set to be able to release. So it was very basically cleaned up. It came with commentaries.
It was vanilla, wasn't it?
It did have commentaries, though.
Right.
So commentaries on each story with Tom on three of them, Mary on four, I think, etc., etc. This story didn't have either of them. It had Bruce Purchase and Pennant Roberts, the director. And it was also the only story with special features. It just had the raw film trims of the exterior footage. Now, when it came time to be released properly as part of the range with full-blown special features and what have you, they had all the film trimmings, of course. And when they had the film trimmings, they recreate as much as possible any effects done on film. So for that scene with the Doctor and Prelix superimposed, the scene you really don't like, Todd, and the floating spanner.
Terrible.
They had to recreate that. Now, in the original version, the spanner, after it hits, the explosion goes off, and about half a second later, the spanner disappears.
Oh, and they added a spanner that flies off.
Yeah, pretty much. They took the original spanner, they had it hit, and when the explosion goes off, the spanner spins and flies off. It lasts the same amount of time, it's about half a second, but it doesn't just disappear. So Steve Roberts and the restoration team revealed that they'd done that as part of their website. They had a website they updated with the notes. The internet went insane. And it became known as Spannergate. All these people like, no, you must present it as an alternate option like you do for all the other special effects. And Steve Roberts was coming in and saying, you want us to have an alternate option for a half-second clip? No, we're not doing that. Okay, then put it back the way it was. No, it's gone off for duplication. Live with it, people. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
But to this day, when sort of some of the new series DVDs, for instance, some of the, like, comic relief things what have come out with the wrong music or the wrong sound effects, people always refer back to Spannergate.
So are you saying to me that the version I just watched actually has this spinning spanner and it's not supposed to?
Yeah,
that's right.
Oh my goodness.
I feel cheated.
Yes, I'm going to post something to the internet.
Avast ye, listeners, that's all the time we have for The Pirate Planet, but do join us next week for The Stones of Blood. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. Don't forget, bondfinger.com, you can download all of our James Bond commentaries, and you can find us as bondfingercast on Twitter and bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes. Until next week, may your polyphase avatron not make a yellow laser mess on the floor. I'm Brendan, thank you very much, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bealby, Nathan Bottomley, and Brendan Jones. This episode, Buck's Fizz, was recorded on the 4th of October. The next episode will be released on December 20th. You may find our podcast crude, but we hope it was immensely satisfying.
Why is the toilet still going? Do you want me to go and deal with that?
Oh, just sort of press the button halfway down. Yeah. Not actually, it's not coming through the mics, which is good, but yeah. It's all happening, dear listeners. Oh, see, now I can hear it.